next page in our calendar is Justine Keith versus Youngstown Diocese of the Catholic Church. Mr. Frank.
Honorable Chief Justice, fellow justices of the Ohio Supreme Court, good morning. My name is John Frank, and together with Mary Beth Hauser, we are here today on behalf of the Youngstown Diocese of the Catholic Church. Thank you for accepting jurisdiction of this discretionary appeal. The diocese offers three initial observations about this appeal. First, this case comes before this court on a very clear and well-developed set of facts established through extensive discovery at the trial court level. Second, this appeal is narrowly focused upon the effect of a whistleblowing employee's admitted misconduct and the concealment of that misconduct during the whistleblowing report. The diocese has asserted these arguments from the very beginning of the trial court. However, the Fifth District Court of Appeals, both its decision and also its response to the application for reconsideration, was completely silent about the effect of these defenses. Rather, it focused exclusively in its opinion about the sufficiency of Mrs. Keith's compliance with the written report requirement under 41.13.52.
Is the proposition of law you're looking for from this court embodied in a statement that you would want post-discovery of termination wrongdoing to be have as much efficacy as discovery before termination?
Certainly, Justice.
Is that the issue?
That's one of the issues, Your Honor. Certainly, Justice Douglas, the act required evidence doctrine, which I think is what you're addressing, is one of the four arguments that the diocese is proposing to this court as a basis to reverse the Fifth District Court of Appeals. The third initial observation that I'd like to make is that this appeal fortuitously responds to a concern which Justice Piper expressed in his concurring opinion in Culch versus Structural Fibers, where he noted that recognition of a common law public policy claim for whistleblowers must allow for the development of a wide range of reasonable defenses so that the entire story of an employment termination can be told. I have prepared a brief summary of the facts. If the court would like it, we'd like me to proceed to argument. I'm happy to do that.
We've read the facts, so unless they're different than what you have in the brief, you might want to
proceed to argument. Your Honors, we present four basic arguments for the reversal of the Fifth Court of Appeals decision. Two of these arguments relate to the strength of Mrs. Keith's current basic claim under the whistleblower statute and the companion public policy. And the other two arguments relate to affirmative defenses. I'll begin first with those two arguments which relate to the prima facie whistleblower claim. Essentially, these two arguments can be classified or categorized as a classic person's argument, claiming that Mrs. Keith does not fall or fit within the class of persons whom the legislature and this court intended to protect through the whistleblower statute and the companion public policy. To support this argument, we note that the express language of the statute requires good faith on the part of the whistleblower. Also, we can find from looking at a variety of different resources and references that there is also a requirement that a whistleblower act with unpolluted and benign motive. To support this argument, we look to five sources of authority or instruction that tell us that there needs to be good faith on the part of the whistleblower and that the whistleblower needs to act with unpolluted motive. The first is the profile of the model or prototype whistleblower, Dr. Peter Funk, who was the personality behind Funk versus Waste Management. In that case, Dr. Peter Funk was someone who was completely selfless. He exalted the public interest over any individual interest. Actually, he was harmed personally by standing up for the public right to an environment without pollution. The second area where we find support for a reasonable and good faith requirement, as well as an unpolluted motive requirement, would be in the legislative history and language. When the statute was first introduced, the legislature required, or the committee required, that everyone be protected except a whistleblower who actually knew their report was false. However, by the time the legislation made its way to the House Ethics and Standards Committee, the legislature had already adopted a requirement that the employee must make a reasonable and good faith effort to determine the accuracy of the information which they report.
Now, counsel,
yes.
in and you probably go to the third point of the intent of the statute would be really to make the public or the, I'm sorry, make authorities aware of some condition that could be typically dangerous to the rest of other people in society. And the concept that and your point that somebody who helps falsify a report, for instance, should not get the protection because that's directly related to the harm that is the public is being subjected to. But your first point is that this person should be sinless, and that any sins, or even tangentially related, which in this case Mrs. Keith's sins, if you want to call it, are tangential. I mean, they weren't part of the conduct that she reported about IRS reporting violations was separate from her own. Just so happened she too was arguably cheating on her compensation or her taxes, but they weren't related. I mean, if the concept is let's get things reported to authorities that are harmful, even why should we distinguish between the reporter who is without any sin and we let them be protected even though they happen to don't recycle or something like that? I mean, why should we, what's the point of that when the policy is let's get stuff reported?
First of all, I'd like to respond to the first comment that you made about requiring that a whistleblower be sentenced. We're not necessarily recommending that the court adopt that standard, that a whistleblower, in order to be protected under both the statute and the common law, needs to be this perfect person.
But you raised the idea of Fung being without, just such a great example.
And I mentioned that, Justice, because he clearly was the impetus.
Yes, I realize that. But do you think personalities, I guess that's my point, do personalities and
should
background...
Should we be talking about motive? What is the motive that causes the person to be a whistleblower?
Certainly motive is relevant, and that's one of the arguments under the class of person argument.
And that's why when we're talking about when someone themselves perhaps has some wrongdoing, then you have to examine their motive more importantly.
Justice Cook, if I could just respectfully disagree with respect to the categorization of Mrs. Keith's conduct, she committed the very same allegations, the very same violations that she had brought to the attention of Father Moby, except she had done so for 6 years. The exact same thing, not paying income tax, not paying Social Security. I think that there's a very close kinship there. And I think that form of tort law requires that when someone discloses something, they have a duty to speak completely, yet partial speaking will leave misimpressions, and that's certainly what happened here. I'd like to continue on with respect to the legislative history and language argument. As I mentioned, the legislature in the final draft of the statute, which was enacted, requires a reasonably good faith effort to determine the accuracy of information. This court can take judicial notice of what accuracy means. Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary defines it as conforming exactly to truth, free from error, and exactness. Another area where we find support for our arguments is in this court's precedent. In the past 3 years, this court has decided 3 significant whistleblower cases. Perhaps the most instructive for this appeal would be the case of Fox versus Bowling Green, wherein a unanimous court determined that a reasonable belief standard rather than actual violation standard applied, and that the statute protected people so long as they reasonably believed that what they were reporting was a felony or something that endangered the public. In the Fox versus Bowling Green opinion, again speaking through Justice Piper, the court gave somewhat of a profile of a whistleblower as being someone who is vigilant, attuned to public safety, loyal to the employer, and sometimes even brave, but not infallible. We respectfully submit that Fox Court intended to tolerate honest mistakes on the part of a whistleblower, not deliberate concealment.
Are you contending that the IRS problems were not mistakes and not deliberate concealment?
No, whatever. Justice Stratton is Mrs. Keith's deliberate concealment of her own violations when she went to her.
There is no real dispute that the other bookkeeper was doing the same thing.
There is no dispute about that.
And so if you have a woman who turns in her box for violating the law, even though she's also violating the law, I guess I'm going to the Justice Cook's premise, we are still accomplishing the goal of the whistleblower statute in that fraud, corruption, or misdeeds are being exposed. Why does the motive then of the person enters, and why should that be something we look at?
I guess you look at the public policy justice draft and what it's trying to accomplish. It's trying to accomplish reporting things that present a danger to the public or that are felonies. How far does that public policy go? Does it go along?
Let me challenge that public policy then. If you set up a proposition in law that says, if you're committing a violation yourself and you turn your boss in for a violation, you don't get protection, then aren't we then encouraging people to keep covering up this thing, both their own and the others, because of the fear that they will get protected because they might have something in their past? We're having the opposite effect that we're making two fraud stay covered instead of letting at least one of them out.
I understand your position. And your point is well taken, that there is a public interest, without a doubt, in having any type of wrongdoing disclosed. Without a doubt, there is. But does that public policy require that the individual who is concealing her own misconduct be rewarded, in essence, get the remedies that the statute offers, reinstatement, back pay, the remedies, the broader remedies, which this court recognized in Kulch? Does the public policy require that individual to be rewarded for concealing her own misconduct?
Well, I guess the idea is that we fear that folks won't report if they don't at least consider that they have this protection. But maybe your point is that they'll nonetheless report, but then they're assessed later in terms of motive whether or not they reap the protection.
Correct. And in this case, I would draw your attention to the deposition testimony. It's so very clear what the purpose of this going to bother what he wants, because she was upset because she felt that Mrs. Harvey had taken away her vacation pay. And when she was asked why she did not disclose her own violations to Father Lodi during the whistleblowing report, she flippantly responded, "He's the pastor. It was his job to do that." Proceeding on, the fourth place where we find support for our argument with respect to class of persons is in Justice Brown's dissenting opinion in Fong versus Waste Management. He noted that public policy should protect legitimate attempts to serve the public interest. Nothing is mentioned about companion private interests. And then finally, we cited at length various cases from sister jurisdictions which have embraced our arguments, most notably our Midwest contiguous state, Michigan. Most notably, in Wolcott versus Champion International, the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Michigan refused to allow a whistleblower to recover under the whistleblower statute because he actually had participated in the wrongdoing which he had reported. Furthermore, it was clear that he had a very personal motive.
I don't have any problem with it when they participated in the wrongdoing, but if they had their own sense of wrong, they did not participate in the wrongdoing. What I'm afraid of is if we adopt the principle that you have, is someone who has any wrongdoing in their own past into a turn anybody in. And so aren't we defeating the purpose of the whistleblower statute? Are we better off saying, okay, she did something wrong, she gets exposed to the process of turning in her boss, we deal with her separately. Iron prosecutes her separately. She pays her own penalty for her own mistake.
No, Your Honor. Again, you know, that is a public policy. That is against any time any wrongdoing is reported. But again, it all goes to the strength of the public policy and the weighing process. We are not proposing that if a person has a least little violation in their personnel file, for instance, absenteeism or some other problem, that would be something that would undermine their motive and their good faith requirement for a whistleblower claim. But again, as I noted in responding to Justice Cook's question, there's a very, very close correlation in connection between the subject matter of Mrs. Key's violation and the violation which she reported. They were essentially the same.
But she did not participate
in what the school was doing?
She did not participate in their own hiring.
It is in the record, Your Honor, that she did receive $1,000 through that particular experience, and that she was one of the individuals affected, and that is in the record. In addition, participated in it, you know, to the extent that she received benefits. So let me make sure that that's actually as I expressed it.
Was she aware that that was meant to for wrongfully taken from the child? Is that
incorrect? Well, that's debatable. She never admitted in the deposition that she thought that what she had done was wrong from 1986 to 1992.
You're saying that apparently the IRS thought wrongly gave her $1,000. Was she aware when she got that $1,000 from the diary that she shouldn't be getting it? Well, because a lot of times with employees, you don't necessarily know what the boss is doing to create a
bond. I would presume, Your Honor, that she was because her practice had stopped in 1992 when she received that practice. She received that $1,000 after 1992. And I would presume that after she stopped her own pattern of income tax and social security evasion, that she realized that she shouldn't be doing it. She received that $1,000 after 1992, so I'm presuming that yes, she would have been aware that it was wrong.
It seems to me in making your unclean hands argument that you're conceding that the firing was in retaliation for the whistleblowing.
Justice Douglas will make no such concession. We are here. Based upon a summary judgment that was entered in its entirety by the trial court, and we're up here before this court on a very limited issue. We do not concede that she falls within, aside from the sake of argument, we do not concede that she falls.
Well, but if you're only up here on the summary judgment argument and not on the merits of that summary judgment, if we affirm, you lose.
Well, whatever.
And when I look at your sole proposition of law, you say unclean hands, falls outside the class of persons protected under the public policy, and you limit it to that.
In the trial court, you know, again, it was resolved on the summary judgment. We have never conceded that Mrs. Key, aside from the misconduct, is a whistleblower. In fact, the Fifth District Court of Appeals even said that it had to go back for more fact-finding. That reasonable lines could differ as to whether her written report sufficed or not. So even on that issue alone, it has to go back to the trial court, according to the Fifth District Court of Appeals.
Well, even forgetting that issue of whether it has to go back and what the Court of Appeals said on that issue that you've just recited, why aren't you arguing the fundamental issue that she was fired because she was going outside the chain of command and she was not being honest with her employer and forgetting all this after discovery?
Justice Douglas, there certainly is plenty of evidence of lack of cooperation and so forth, but that could be the subject of disputed facts that a jury would need to resolve, whether there was in fact lack of cooperation and so forth.
Well, then even an affirmance is going to permit you to go back and do that.
An affirmance? Yes, that's correct.
But if we reverse it, you want a finding for defendant.
That's correct. We believe that the four arguments that we have, the class of persons argument under the polluted faith requirement, the unpolluted motive requirement, and then the affirmative defenses with respect to finding clean hands and accurate prior evidence, any one of those would be sufficient to reverse.
Thank you.
Do you agree that the Court of Appeals, as you know, based much of its decision on the fact that this was whether there's been a written notification to the employer? What's your strongest argument? There is a letter, as you know, and that the Court of Appeals relied on. What's your argument on that issue?
But just looking at to make sure that the diocese is understood, you know, we did not raise that issue as a proposition of law.
Right.
We respectfully disagree that there is a fact issue. That's all the Fifth District determined was that there was a fact issue that these lines could differ. They didn't say that the written report was sufficient. We have to go back to the trial court to confess that it was sufficient. I see that the light is on, Your Honor.
Your time is set up.
Thank you.
After the oral argument, the case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.